Hello. You muted, John?
I'm on.
Ah, there you are. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon and good morning to you.
Yeah.
Good morning, good morning.
Yeah, I remember that tune.
Yeah. Oh, well, how are you? How's it going today?
I'm at my daughter's apartment, so I'm hanging out here. And after I Zoom with you, I'm going to head home because she's coming home today. So okay, I'm doing good.
Okay, great. So we have about an hour. Is that okay? An hour and a half?
Hour and a half is fine.
Okay, great. I'll try to watch the clock here. I have some ideas. They're coming to me very quickly. Okay. I just did a review last night of the talk we had on Tuesday, Lisa's class.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched it, I took a few notes, and I was very stimulated by that conversation. And I'd like to hear your feedback on that conversation. And maybe I already have some questions, and I already have an exercise that I've set up. And I want to share it with you so that then we could perform it in this space today. If that sounds good.
That sounds really good, John. Just to let you know, I'm really open to any guidance or whatever you want to do with this because I just appreciate the support that we both have from different places about trying to get this out, you know?
Yeah, I just had a quotation from this book. I haven't read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very famous book. It's called Personal Knowledge.
Oh, wow.
Michael Polanyi. And I just found a quotation from it, which I've just lost. Oh, here it is. And I think this resonates a little bit because of our discussion on Tuesday. and I'll just quote it. It's just a very short paragraph. The paradox raised by Einstein as a schoolboy about the behavior of light in a laboratory moving with the speed of light was resolved only by Einstein's reform of the concept of simultaneity and his co-joint establishment of special relativity. The fundamental part played by various logical and semantic paradoxes in stimulating the recent conceptual development in logic is equally notorious. I believe that the solution of philosophic puzzles, like that raised by the question whether we can predict our own actions, may also lead to important conceptual discoveries. And he goes on to say, I am attempting to resolve by conceptual reform the apparent self-contradiction entailed in believing what I might conceivably doubt, which is a little complex there. I'm just unpacking it for myself because I think the image of Einstein, which we talked about, that he was riding a beam of light and he had a mirror in front of him, which was beyond the speed of light. And he was speculating about, well, if the mirror is beyond the speed of light, would my image appear or not in the mirror? Very complex concept there, but it was generated by an embodied kinesthetic proprioceptive capacity that he had. In other words, he's using his imagination.
Yeah, no, exactly. He, you know, if you don't mind me just drifting for a minute, in the sense that that's why I liked you said about the eroticism, because uh-huh. An embodied life has that element of the erotic. Now, I'm using it really broad. I'm not
Could
using
you say
it.
More about that? Could you say more about that erotic a lived life?
Well, I guess I'm taking it from understanding that from Greek and even different cultures, that the erotic being the spark, the energy that moves all life forms, that's erotic. And it's played out when we make love, because that's in a micro situation, you know?
Right.
I just think that there's a lot of misconceptions and fear around it, because we keep the erotic only in the lower half and not all through the body.
That's right. So we tend to reduce the erotic to sex, which
right.
It isn't, of course. Yeah.
Right.
And so the erotic includes and also embraces lots of different forms of love.
And this is where the senses come in. The sensuality comes in as part of that eroticism too. And some people conflate being sensuous with being sexual.
That's
in the sense that the lower part of just sex, they're not, they play together, but they're not, the sensual part can be expanded without necessarily being an act of sex.
Right. So you could, I'm not a wrestler, you are, but you could, wrestling could be a form of erotic without being sexual.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's a good way to put it, because it's my senses coming in touch with somebody else's body and what I do with it.
Right.
And how I work
There's
with it.
There's certainly excitement and emotional
yeah. part. But you can't talk, you in re, even in wrestling, you can't use the word erotic in wrestling.
Right. I think that's because we have such a narrow idea of what erotic includes, you know?
Yes, exactly.
So now I'm going to run this by you. That was great, because personal knowledge is sort of the theme I'm working with here. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this book, which I haven't read, with a book I've half read called The Evolution of Knowledge, which is by Jürgen Rinn.
Okay.
So this is what I'm drawing from now. Some of the themes, like the conceptual and the perceptual and the gap between, and how we can go meta into more and more concepts, and how that can lead sometimes to a disconnect with the somatic intelligence and with the immediate environment that we're located in.
Yes.
And I think, well, what are we going to do about that? And I sort of wanted to explore how we might create emergent knowledge, how we can draw upon models that we already know and have already used and apply that knowledge or transmit it to one another, share it with the expectation that new models would emerge through that kind of transmission and development and evolution, no doubt. So if we've studied Gebser, we've studied, we've talked considerably in the last conversation about structures that unfold or stages that transcend and include. Using that latter, neither one of us like particularly well. And I think that that has lived consequences, how we use metaphor, how we use story, how we use language to share and transmit and open possibilities for emergent knowledge. Mm-hmm. So this is what I was thinking about. You saw the I sent to you the link to a exercise I did with Marco on
I watched it very, very intrigued and intensely.
Great. Now that was a process called open clean space, which I learned from David Grove a number of years ago, and I've used it many times in combination with clean language. And David called what he was doing emergent knowledge. So he was creating processes where the knowledge could emerge from the self, from the self with other selves. I think I've taken it into the group process quite a bit on our online, in this online community, which is a very big challenge for me, because if I'm in the same room with a group of people, it's very different from being on a flat screen with a group of people.
Very true. Very true.
And that's where my challenge is, and continuing, that's an ongoing challenge, yet I have to learn how to adapt, because this is the direction that our culture is going in.
Right.
And nothing right now is happening on the ground. Nothing. Mm-hmm. It's closing down. The city's closing down again. I tried to get tickets to go to MoMA, to the Museum of Modern Art, and they're closed. They're not picking up their phone. So it looks like we're having another wave of, and the schools closed yesterday. Mm-hmm. So with all of that, what would I like to have happen? Well, let's make the most of these opportunities on the flat screens that we have available to us. Mm-hmm. And so if we were to look at the Gebser model and explore it spatially, this is how I envision it happening. You can move around in that space that you're so, and you saw how I did it with Marco. He was in his study and he was moving around in his space. He was basically marking each space. So go to a space that knows about this, whatever it is, then unpack that, unload it, whatever's happening in that space that you know. Now find another space that knows something about whatever. Then you can create different spaces and you can mark them, and you can have a psychosomatic experience in that space, okay, in which way a dancer does or an actor does. And then you can, at the end of it, having anchored these psychosomatic neurological feeling states, you can move from space to space with what you learned. So I can, now what do you know now when you go back to this space? What do you know now when you go back to that space? So if I were to invite you to consider the stages or the structures of Gebser, we're talking about the archaic, the magical, the mythical, and the mental. And so what I propose is, I'll just give you the outline of my proposal and then we can do it.
Okay, I'm just, I know that you require some sticky, so I'm trying to.
That would help. That would help. So you can mark your spot.
What? So that sounds really erotic.
Oh, okay. Whatever spot you want.
Okay. Sorry, John. Sorry.
No problem. So I'm going to mark out these spaces according to wherever you want them to be in your location there. The archaic, the magical, the mythical, the mental. And I'm just going to ask you, find a space that knows about the archaic.
Archaic, a space for the archaic.
Now, this is your option. You can decide which structure you want to find first, or we can do them in the logical order that Gebser presents it in his book.
Why don't we, because I have a sense of where you're going with this because of watching it, why don't we just do it with the logical order?
Okay, so we'll just do it we'll go to archaic, then magical, then mythical, then mental, and then we'll find a space that knows all about those spaces. And that will be a real mind fuck.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Okay. So step number one, and I'm being very procedural. I'm good. I will take notes and I will listen to what you record.
Okay.
And you're going to be on the ground finding those spaces. So find a space that knows about the archaic.
Can you see me?
I can't see you, but I can hear you.
Okay.
That's fine.
Let me try to move it and see if you can see.
Okay.
Hey, John, only because
you want to put it on. That's great.
The archaic is here, but it's pointing to the restroom around the corner.
Okay. And so stay located there.
Oh, stay located there.
Okay, and you're looking at it, right?
Yes.
That's what it is. Okay. Is that at the right height?
Yes.
Are you at the right distance from it?
Yes.
Okay. So what do you know from that space there about the archaic? And by the way, you don't have to direct this to me. You can direct it to you're in that space, so you can report from the space, but you don't have to worry about turning it into a conversation with me, okay?
Okay, so yeah, I'll just talk to myself and you listen.
Yeah, better. and you can look at the where it is.
The archaic is the power of the earth, the mother, the womb. The seeing that is with feeling and not sight.
Feeling without sight.
And seeing with feeling.
And seeing with feeling. And the power of the earth, mother, womb.
And boundaries that do not have any density.
And boundaries that do not have any density. And is there anything else that you know from there about the archaic?
It's where I come from.
It's where I come from. Thank you. So, now, find another space. I'm writing all this down, Michael, but if there's something you need to jot down for yourself, please do.
I'm just doing the magical sticker, that's all. But can you hear me well enough from where I'm talking?
I can. I could hear you from over there.
Okay.
The intention here is I want it to be a immersive experience for you, so you don't have to worry about having a conversation with me.
Thank you.
So you can just go right into your landscape.
Okay.
Okay, so find a space that knows about magical.
I'm there.
Is that the right height?
Yes.
Is it at the right distance?
Yes.
And what do you know from there about the magical?
That shape and form becomes a focus of interest, of how shape and form are in my field of vision.
And shape and form are in your field of vision.
And there's light and energy. There's even dark energy with light energy. And energy is excitement.
And energy is excitement.
There's something within my own life form that is touching something outside that is giving life inside.
And is there anything else that you know from there about the magical?
It's scary.
It's scary. Thank you. Now find a space that knows about the mythical.
I'm going to do this because just trying to orientate.
Great. Is that at the right height?
Now it is.
Are you at the right distance?
Yes.
And what do you know from there about the mythical?
Sounds and repeating sounds with my own mouth. Feeling the vibration within my body and speaking to the sounds that I hear.
And feeling the vibrations in your own body. And repeating sounds. And is there anything else you know there about the mythical?
That I'm in dialogue with my surround. I'm speaking to it, trying to shape some kind of connection.
And shape connection in a dialogue with your surround. And is there anything else you know from there about the mythical?
there's a sense of participation and interaction.
A sense of participation and interaction. And what just happened?
Repeat the question.
And what just happened? Those movements that you're making.
I'm actually touching another life form like myself.
And touching a life form like yourself. Thank you. And now find a space that knows about the mental. Is that the right height? Are you at the right distance?
Now I am.
And what do you know from there about the mental?
There's a focus that has clarity and depth.
A focus that has clarity and depth. And is there
anything in front of me? It's in front of me.
In front of you. And is there anything else you know from there about the mental?
Yes, there's an intensity I'm not familiar with.
An intensity that you're not familiar with. And is there anything else you know from that space about the mental?
I'm viewing and interacting with others differently with a sense of mixture of feelings in my chest and feelings coming from others.
The mixture of feelings in your chest and feelings in the other. Thank you. And now, what I would invite you to do, I think I would call iteration or reiteration. Can you go back to the first one, to the archaic, to the space that knows about the archaic?
Yes, I'm there.
And what do you know now? About the archaic.
Less fear.
Less fear. Thank you. Can you go to the magical space? And what do you know now? about the magical.
Possibilities.
Now, can you return to the mythical space?
Oh, forgot where it was at.
That's why I have the marks there.
Okay.
And what do you know now about the mythical?
The source of the mythical is in the magical.
And the source of the mythical is in the magical.
And the mythical, I'm sorry,
go on.
And the mythical is articulating more form, more engagement with the magical.
More form and more engagement with the magical. Thank you. And to the mental space? And what do you know now about the mental?
There's a confusion. There's this split of looking forward and not wanting to look backward, not wanting to feel what's behind me. Cut off what I feel behind me, only look forward.
And a split between the forward and the back and looking behind you.
Yeah, feeling behind me too.
Thank you. Now, one more space. Find a space that knows about all of those spaces. Is that the right distance? Is that the right height?
Yeah.
Great. And what do you know from there about all of those spaces?
I'm in the center.
In the center.
And the center is felt in my feet. And the energy from the center from my feet goes all the way up.
And the energy from your feet goes all the way up.
And I can look in any direction to the previous places I have been, and there's a weaving together.
And you can look in any direction where you've been, and a weaving together. And yeah, is there anything else?
There's a freedom within this. There's a freedom within this spatial limitation, because there's still some a feeling of limitations of how far, you know, I can only look this way, I can look this way. So, but there's a freedom of movement, I guess, within.
Freedom of movement?
Yeah.
Thank you. And now if you want to come back and join me, and thank you very much. I just want to ask, once more, this is about reiteration. What do you know now about yourself? Or about Gebser that you did not know before this exercise.
I would have to say that the knowing is embodied, but not contained.
The knowing is embodied, but not contained. And when the knowing is embodied, but not contained, what difference does knowing that make?
The difference is my relationship to movement from within or without.
Your relationship to movement from within and without. And what difference does knowing that make?
Releasing, a sense of release from not being able to move.
Release from not being able to move. And what difference does knowing that make?
Less fear.
Less fear. And what difference does knowing that make?
Freedom of movement.
Freedom of movement. And freedom of movement, and what difference does knowing that make?
My heart beats very, very slowly, and I am one with my heartbeat.
And heart beats very, very slowly, and you are at one with your heartbeat. Is that a good place to pause?
Sure, sure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I guess I was exploring how to create emergent knowledge and how to transmit knowledge from one model to another area that we want to learn about. So I would invite both of us to maybe have an open frame.
Okay.
And we can go, you know, wherever we want with this. I have my desired outcomes, you have your desired outcomes, and those may be changing even as we have this conversation. And I would like to, consider what we've been studying most recently in Lisa's course with the Klein bottle, the Mobius strip. And I think this is something that we could add to the repertoire that we're creating in this repertory company.
I think it's a rep company,
right? And we're all performing here. And we're trying things out.
Mm-hmm.
We enter one space. We make contact with certain states and perhaps structures. And then we go to another space. And we try on another costume. Put on another mask. See how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was, a good demonstration of clean space and how it differs from, but is very similar to, clean language, because I was still using clean questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it wasn't like you were sitting in a chair and I'm sitting in a chair. It's much more about using the body and moving around and letting the space become sort of like an informer. The space teaches us.
Mm-hmm.
And so as someone who's co-exploring with you, this was a very useful exercise for me. And when I get to view this again, I will probably know more then than I know now.
Yeah.
That's what's so great about this archive. As I've gone back, and I'm probably the only one who does this, I go back and I watch these events that I participated in, and I realize how much I missed the first time. And I can then become aware of that, and hopefully the next time I get together, I can feed that back into my communications.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that was so interesting about the archives that we have available to us now. This is probably the first time in history that any group has been able to reflect upon its own groupness in this way before. So it's not just about me and another person. It's about my relationship to this group as it evolves and changes.
Well, over several years. And what I find interesting, John, is I do too go back to the archives, maybe not as much as you, but I do because I personally go back. I look at everybody, but I focus on my own communication and interaction. And with the archive, that's one thing that can support working with this difficult medium, because now I can see how, just like, you know, in an actual rehearsal, the director is trying to do it. Well, this archive is giving, like a director, giving me feedback so that I can find how I'm in the scene that I'm supposed to be playing, like on Zoom, like what we're doing now, you know, and it can help me work with the anxiety that you and I both kind of acknowledge in trying to work with this kind of medium. One thing I found interesting in doing that is, I don't know if I'm going to say this right. It's physicality, that making physical, this screen makes physical maybe the screens of my own mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, that this is a, like McLuhan is trying to say, this is externalizing how we may it be doing the same thing in our own mind when we're viewing our thoughts and feelings and having a trouble how to relate to that within ourselves.
And trouble relating to that, screens of your own mind.
Yeah, because there's a metaphor for the mind as a screen. Uh-huh. Not just not just a mirror, but as a screen, the screen of your own mind, you know, that you project.
And a screen of your own mind, which you project. And when a screen of your own mind, which you project, is there anything else about that screen?
Well, I think one of the things is for me, paying attention to the somatic body affect, which includes the emotions, because to project takes energy. You have to have a certain intense energy to be projecting, you know, and I'm kind of using that projection in a kind of just very mechanical way to throw a ball. When we project, it's kind of like that. Can we get so sensitive to the subtle way our minds throw itself out, like we throw a ball? Yeah. This is a movement too. This is a movement. So, and I think intensity has a lot to do with this movement. There, something has to come about to, oh my God, ooh, go, boom, you know? Or in Aikido, it's about moving.
And intensity, and Aikido is about moving.
And this is where I tied to Getzer, because I really resonated of how much he used that word to show where mutations begin with intensity. If you don't have intensity, there's not going to be a mutation.
And Getsu's mutations and intensity and the Aikido and project throwing a ball and that somatic body affect. And is there anything else about somatic body affect?
Yeah, very much so. Giving attention to your intention sets the conditions for all else.
And giving attention to your intention. And when giving attention to your intention, that's like what?
Well, what came to mind is watching my children when they're first, you know, when especially after they walk and they're moving around, their attention from an adult is all over the place, but there is such a focus on what they're going to pay attention to. Can adults get that back?
Can an adult get that back?
Yes, with practice, with unlearning.
Yes, with practice. And that, and when, yes, with practice, what kind of practice?
I think the main practice is learning how to stay alert and relax at the same time.
Alert and relaxed. At the same time. And is there anything else?
Only that it is possible. It's up to each individual.
It is possible. And up to each individual. And when it is possible, and it's up to each individual, what happens to the screen of the mind?
I'm going to have to go. I don't know how to give an image or words to that. I just don't. I don't have any resources to draw on to do it justice, I feel.
And you don't know how to draw upon
resources to give it justice. I'm at a place where I'm not sure how to give it justice. I can't think of any metaphor.
I'm going to go out on a limb with you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Can you find a space that knows how to give justice to those resources? I'm not getting the words exactly right. When you don't know.
Well, I think in order to find that space, I think the first step is to slow down and possibly sit still.
And slow down and possibly sit still.
Yeah, because
then what happens?
We say again?
And when slow down, sit down. I think you said slow down, sit down.
Sit still.
Sit still.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
Then there's a balance. There's more, there's a dynamic balance between stillness and movement. You feel enlivened by a dynamic balance rather than a overwhelming polarity.
And a dynamic balance rather than an overwhelming polarity. And when a dynamic balance is there a relationship between that dynamic balance rather than a polarity and watching children focus?
Yes, there is. There is, because children naturally are activating that or are in that dynamic naturally. And in a polarized state, we've lost resource to that. We've unresourced ourselves from it.
Thank you. Can you pause again?
Yeah.
I thought that reminded me of what Lisa said the other day about rules, how children are pre-polarity. They don't have polarity responses. They just take on another character in the drama that they're creating with their caldates here. And then we get older and we apply rules.
Right.
And then those rules start to sort of rigidify and freeze our natural unpolarized responses. And she speculated, could be the beginning of our kind of a, what's the word, polarity response. So that it becomes an either or. You can't have both and or a neither nor. So I think that's sort of something that I'm learning about. And hopefully, I was speaking to somebody else previously. I posted something. And I, for the first time, I described myself as a triage nurse, where I have to, because I have to make choices about what I'm going to have to let go of in this circumstance, and what I want to hold on to, what could still be worth developing. Mm-hmm. And to use that metaphor, which is the first time I've ever used that metaphor before, I recall the first time I went to an emergency room with a dearly loved friend that I was very responsible for, because he wasn't any longer responsible for himself and his family had abandoned him. Oh. So I was the only contact he really had. Mm-hmm. And I took him to the hospital in the emergency room, and I watched the triage nurse work with him. You know, she just took his pulse. She was very calm. She was quite serene. She asked him a few questions, which he couldn't answer quite clearly, but I was there to support him. And I could see her making an assessment, and she moved him into a hospital bed at that moment, and then keeping him hours in the emergency room because it wasn't that serious. You know how emergency rooms operate, because
yes,
I know
your
daughter is a nurse.
Yeah.
But I realized that is a real reason. That's something that I can tap into, that kind of serenity that triage nurse had.
Exactly.
Emergency situation. Because she knew the resources the hospital has. She knows how many patients are there who need attending. She knows how many rooms are available for whatever purpose. And she's looking at this particular person in front of her and taking their pulse and looking at their, asking them questions. So she has to make all these very quick decisions. But I think this is, that is a metaphor. It's not the metaphor. But
yeah,
I think that there's a relationship in a way between giving attention and intention and watching children and that somatic body affect and what I'm offering for my own metaphorical landscape that's emerging even as I speak, because I haven't really talked to anyone about this before. But I feel that these are, when we're up against it, as I believe many of us are, and some of us are feeling that anxiety, and rather being defensive about our anxiety, can we go into the anxiety and oscillate in between anxious to maybe calmer, go back to anxious, having experienced calm, and then the anxiety isn't a debilitating one anymore. Somehow you can deal with it. And so we're not, let's just forget about the anxiety. Let's sweep it under the rug, but we're not trapped in it either.
And no, I think John, I love what you're saying, and I hope this doesn't, what I'm about to say, I'm just concerned about how graphic I'm going to be.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I associate working with anxiety is when I have to go pee and there's no place to go.
Oh, that happens to me a lot.
Yeah, but well, yeah, me too. Or, but learning how to work with, okay, that's a felt energy.
Yeah.
If I get more panic or, see, that's just, that's anxiety. Tell me you got something to take care of.
Right. I think that's a widespread problem right now because all the, in Manhattan, all the restrooms are closed.
Yeah.
They want you to go out shopping, but they won't provide you with a restaurant and with a restroom. You go into a cafe, you can buy a cup of coffee and go sit out in the cold because they don't provide you a place to sit, nor do they provide you a place to use the restroom. So it's sort of like, you know what? I can stay home and make coffee. Why should I go out?
Yeah, and they don't want to pay for somebody to sit there and also clean it after each. They don't want to pay for that. And that's ridiculous from my point of view.
That's right. So they just want you to take out food. But it's like for me to go out and go order and sit out in the cold and eat my food, you know, I'd stay home and cook. I don't need to do that. And that's disastrous for the economy. As far as I'm concerned, when you're you want people to go out and spin, but you're creating the conditions where it's not a good idea to go out and spin because you can just might as well just stay home and log on to YouTube, you know, or hopefully find an interesting partner like you and I. We're partners. You're doing this strange kind of ritual, but I think these are the kind of new norms that we could start to. If we give our attention to our intention, we can create conditions for more interesting exchanges that create knowledge rather than just dissipate our energy, you know, sharing our panic attack with somebody. Well, that doesn't do me nor the other person any good. Yeah. You know?
Well, another, and what we just talked about to me, as I was listening to is here again, we're actually disassociating with the body the way they're handling with not, you want people to go shopping, they have to move their bodies, they have to do, but you are making this is the rational deficient, you know, putting all the onus on us to buy, but we have a body that has our organic timing, not a mechanical timing. And so that's, to me, it's a further disassociating from a body. There are times we need to, I think you've said this, I learned that anything, like let's say disassociation, there is an element of intelligence for it. It's when it becomes a habitual instead of the intelligent might be only to service in this moment, not all the time. So it's intelligence and then wisdom of when is it called for and when is it not called for,
right. And I'm just adding the power of rhythm and knowing the rhythmic different kinds of rhythms, the different tempo rhythms of different kinds of systems, and the mental tends to be very rigid and regimented and very externally oriented. It's not checking into the rhythms of the magical and the mythical, which are different kinds of rhythms that can make the mental function more effectively. In the deficient form, though, the mental does not recognize anything except the mental. It's not paying attention to the bodies of those persons around them and the demands of those rhythms, the sleeping, the resting.
Yeah, because those rhythms are in the body and the mental is under the illusion it doesn't need those rhythms.
That's right.
You need those rhythms, but you also need the mental and the mythical come in line as how do we play with those? How do we play with those rhythms and stuff?
That's
and I want to touch on this thing about rules because, and I don't know if I'm going to say it right. Was man made for rules or was rules made for man? Okay, and my understanding developmentally, we need rules, guidelines, because like we were talking about with children, they're in a marvelous place, but sometimes they go too far in their it's not necessarily a psychological pathology, but they go too far. And so good parenting is to kind of set guardrails, but not imprison the child, work with that to help guide. I always, when I parented, I thought my rules is guidelines, and it linguistically, it helped me not make the rules in stone, like, and rigidified, if that makes sense.
It does. Wow, this has given me a great deal to think about. I feel very satisfied about the work that we've done so far. I'm going to contact our friend Seth. I'm going to see him this weekend. I think on Sunday, we're making plans.
Oh, good, good.
And I want to send him this this video so that he might be able to take a meta perspective.
He knows
this technique really well. So he could give me some feedback on my performance. And when we all get together the next time, and I hope we will be able to do a Zoom call with the three of us, he could be the meta person, which I think is very useful for these kinds of interactions we have. So that we can go from a dyad to a triad.
Yes,
and then back
right.
to a dyad, you know?
Yeah.
And different kinds of dyads. I think that would enliven the kind of large group. Well, we don't have too many large groups anymore. We used to have them up to 15, 20 people in some of those study groups. But I think we're down to like 5 or 6 people in this this current course. And I think that's probably the right size for the kind of interactions that we're developing. Because we don't have a moderator who says, okay, I see on the screen here in chat that there's a question. Okay, you can unmute yourself now. And then the person's unmuted. And I feel like I know it's necessary if you're working with large groups to have a management like that, crowd management. But to me, it's so left brain. And so it so totally takes away any spontaneity. And the conversations are getting more and more boring when they're using that kind of, you can unmute yourself now. It's like, I feel like we're turning into robots waiting for someone to tell us we can unmute ourselves. It's not a good, healthy trend, but I think what we're doing is anarchic as it is. I think it can create, when we are able to co-regulate with one another, a kind of camaraderie and a trust factor.
I think we've been actually doing that.
Yeah.
I feel a growth of how we, even before we started using the word co-regulate, I felt it was happening, you know. The last one and the time before that, there were several situations that I know I personally was involved in and probably being a little taking the lead of co-regulating because I wanted to bring that forward. I wanted to really, my intention was to activate that. And one of the things I think, and I just want to add this as part of this, giving attention to our intention, for me, because of my own trauma experience, it's been important to check in with the affect of that in the sense of how much intensity of anxiety, or in another word for anxiety for me is uncertainty. When I go to bring my attention and set my attention to my intention, there's actually, I'm gonna say it this way, maybe it's okay, a half step of checking in with the affect. Because intention has a feeling to me of what would you like to have happen? Well, I need to check, there's a half step of not just bypass that uncertain feeling of making something happen, because in a certain sense, John, I think what we're working with is, and I'm glad the way you bring it in theater, and I really, but we all have high levels of performance anxiety.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And I'm glad the way you work with it, but for me, I have to name it as that performance anxiety so I can work with it.
Right. Or rehearsal anxiety.
No, yeah. Because
I've never seen
anxiety freezes your movement. It has a tendency for me. That's how it can. I've been in places where it's paralyzed me.
And I think that's where, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
I think our bodies know what to do. It's our minds that stop us from expressing it. And so we just sit on it and go into fight, flight, or freeze. Rather than, okay, I am uncertain, this is uncomfortable, you know, but I can, with many practice sessions, get comfortable with how uncomfortable I am. And that's where I think we can do something different that makes a difference, rather than just fall into the same old trauma survivor stance, or
traumatizing
other people with our trauma, which is very ineffective.
Yes.
How can we go into these taboo areas, which have been marked off, don't go there. If we don't ever go there in a public space, they will never transform. They will constantly come at us in ways and shadow figures that, you know, they will overwhelm us. So I think that's where our responsibility, my responsibility as a co-leader, because I think we're both leaders and we're leading together. Very much like a dance, and a good dance, no one knows who's following or leading. It's blending.
That's when it's just the dance. I think in listening to what you're saying, I think we have to talk back to the mind in the sense of trusting the body.
Or
challenge the narrative of the mind of how to relate to our internal experience, and that part that challenges the narrative is an interesting place that you have to find.
That's
to be open to challenge your own narrative. And that's what helped me a lot when I learned how much the way I talk to myself contributes to or distorts my ability to give attention to my intention.
That's right. And I also want to add, the body doesn't know everything.
No, and
the body needs the mind. Yes, we need the interaction and the collaboration. We don't have to. Right now we're in this Cartesian split, like you mentioned, going forward, a split from what's happened in that Cartesian split of the middle mind. It's not necessary for us. We've learned as much as we can from this split mind.
And maybe it's drawing on one of our favorite Carpel. It's flipping the split into a distinction that has porousness.
That's right.
Flip it. It's, you know, flip it out of its rigidity into, okay, it's still a distinction, but it has porousness.
That's right. Which reminds me, I should go back and reread that book, because I read it over a year ago. I think we had a discussion.
Yeah, we had a cafe on it about a year ago.
And I think reviewing some of these texts that we've read and finding applications for them is a very big motivation, because today I feel like we've applied some of what I was reading in this book, Personal Knowledge and Evolution of Knowledge. These are gigantic tomes that gather dust on your shelf if you don't do something with them. You know, you have to go out and find applications, which you've assisted me with today, because I felt like we were applying our knowledge and we were using our knowledge, both the body knowledge, the mind knowledge. We're using all of it and using it as best we can.
Well, what was interesting to me doing, what was helpful for me is, and maybe you've experienced this, I know I'm highly intuitive, but that doesn't mean I know how to interpret it very well. That other side of interpreting is just as valuable as just the intuition. Wilbur one time said that I took from him, you know, you can be 100% intuitive, but if you don't have a good interpretive function, what's going to happen?
That's right. I had a very good friend in the hospital, and the doctor came to visit him, and then the doctor left. And he said he didn't like that doctor. And I said, why? He says, because he doesn't have a very good left brain. he tended to be very scattered and looking at his notes and didn't seem to have a real logical grasp of what's going on. So I appreciate it. There are times when you need a left brain, you know?
Yes.
And you can't just think you can just check out of the left brain and everything's going to go fine, because the right brain, left to its own devices, doesn't give a shit. wants to have fun.
Yeah, and the metaphor dance or movement, and remember a while back, I think it was the one before, I loved what Jeffrey talked about, of the, you know, that sense of kinesthetics, of movement, is really downplayed, and it's a sixth sense.
That's right.
And
that's
the way he explained, which I really related to, that thought movements, you know, of the kinesthetics of thought comes before these other senses in a sense. And I'm just thinking, as you're talking, you know, just below our surface, there's exchanges between the two sides of the brain. And yeah, some people may be more like this, but they still have this. And some people are more like this. But what we need, I think the cultural somatics is as a culture of learning about it in a left brain way. And then like what we did today, go right brain. And now let's apply it. That's what I think we can take from theater. You take the words off the page, put it in your system. You have somebody moving you around, and you're bringing the words to life in a different dimension.
That's right. That's right. And I couldn't have said that better. And maybe that will be our final summary today. I think that you brought in cultural semantics, which is great, because we can post this under that. Also, the sixth sense. Maybe we could use that as our title. Moving towards the sixth sense, or developing the sixth sense. We already have it. It's just about developing it, right? So I think that would be a good title for our work today, as we, you know, post this and anyone who watches it can follow it, and hopefully feed back into, you know, the larger groups that we're working with, both here and elsewhere. I mean, who knows where the boundaries are to this? It's very, not too loose and not too tight, but I think the boundary conditions are such that many, many people now, more than ever before, are feeling the heat, you know. We gotta do something different. We may not know what that is, but let's use all of our knowledge. Let's bring it all together and make sense together as best we can.
Yeah, and I just want to, again, I know I'm a broken record, but almost every time after a cafe I go out in the world, and somehow I have an opportunity to practice what I learned from the cafe.
It's almost like some sort of strange telepathy is happening. The group and what's happening outside of the group. There's a kind of, I don't know, a setup that sort of flows in and out. And I appreciate that too, because I'm feeling less isolated after one of our groups, so that I can go out into the world and start appreciating features of that landscape out there that I probably would have felt alienated from. The isolation is very dangerous for us, because we go chaotic if we get
and the more you isolate, you're interfering with your capacity to relate.
That's right.
You interfere with it. And the major contribution, there's many, but the major contribution that's helped me is borrowing from Aikido, that I can defend myself without trying, because if I try too hard, I'm reactive, I'm defensive. Because what I'm saying is, like just recently, engaging in people and you end up talking about politics, and I can sense where they're coming through, and you give them a point of view that you can feel real quick, you can get the feedback, and you don't have to you don't have to turn it into a reaction.
Right.
But you can tell that they don't like.
That's right.
They don't like it, and you just accept it. It's not about you don't have to force them, but you can feel they don't like it.
And you don't have to fix it.
No, and that's the number one. You don't fix it. But in fact, I've done it enough that sometimes by just modeling that, the conversation can move on.
That's right. That's right. To something that's more resourceful for both of you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where you can maintain the relational aspect, the presence of that, and wait and see. You know, you don't, like you said, I don't have to fix this world. Fuck that shit.
Right.
I want to participate in making it better, but there's no fixing it, in a sense.
So thank you, my friend, Deep Bell.
Thank you.
I had such a lovely afternoon with you.
I did too. I'm glad that we did this, and I'll be waiting to view it and see it posted, John. So
yes,
and have a good day.
I will. You too. See you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
The sixth sense.
Sixth sense.
I'm going out in the world with that sixth sense. Thanks.